in terms of the value of classical conditioning? I mean, at a very basic sort of level here of analysis, preparedness. Okay, we can look at this from an evolutionary perspective here, evolving the capacity to make associations between stimuli means survival, better survival. You're prepared for the CS allows you to prepare for the occurrence of the US, if you will, foresight. If you want to even talk about cognitive systems, you know, if you're cognitively aware of the classical conditioning, you can talk about this in terms of anticipation. So there's some real value here in being ready for things. Zambel and colleagues took a look at this. So male rats give a male repeated access to a receptive female and pair that with an explicit CS. Okay? Then, in future, present the CS to a rat, bring a female rat that's in heat. The male will initiate copulation sooner, ejaculate quicker. You go, oh, it's not so great for the female, is it? You know, it's not drawing anything out. Where's the romance involved? It's very good for the male rat. Other male rats will be competing with him to get access to the females. If a male is going, oh, I don't know if I want to do courtship behaviors with this female, some other male goes, hey, baby, and it's like, oh, lost my chance. Okay, so in this case here, the ability to get an explicit CS there that indicates, hey, female here, competitive advantage over the other males. Hollis, something very similar with blue grommies. These are fish, little freshwater fish that you know, about yay big sort of thing. Males will hold territory. They will attack intruders. Again, condition a light with an intruder. So shine a light. Turn a light on down in the male's territory and then release an intruder. After a number of pairings of light and intruder, now you turn on a light before the intruder has arrived. The male that's got the territory is ready to go. Bam! You know, slams in with the full force of his 26 grams of fish behind him into the intruding male. It's a flurry of attacking fish, fins and lips everywhere, nibbling at his opponent. Yeah, it's horrific, okay? Okay, it's not like sharks, okay? You're not seeing blood in the water. Male grommies that fight, it's more like, you leave, no, you leave. You leave, you leave, no, you leave. Are you going to go? Yeah, okay. Anyways, the resident attacks the intruder sooner, and the resident actually wins more conflicts than previously. So again, being ready to prepare. Now, you know, Hollis didn't look at this in terms of hormones, but you know, Dr. Pete Hurd in the department takes a look at this, has some interesting changes, gets you ready, activates these species-specific defense reactions in terms of your fight or flight, your cortical steroids, your adrenaline gets going a little bit faster there. You're ready to go. You're prepared for the conflict. All right. Now, we can also take a look at this. Concept of preparedness with respect to homeostasis. We talked about homeostatic systems a couple of chapters back or so. And remember, if you remember, we talked about there being a feedback lag in control systems. Okay, so it takes a little while for your control system to realize that the actual input has shifted from the reference input, and then there's some fluctuations. Well, if you bring classical conditioning into this, if we now allow classical conditioning, or there's the capacity in the organism's nervous system to use classical conditioning with respect to homeostatic control systems, the presentation of a stimulus saying, oh yeah, you know what, the temperature's about to change. You know, instead of just going, whoa, it's suddenly cold. How long has that been going? You know, there's a lag there. Instead, if it's like, oh yeah, the light levels are getting lower. I bet night's coming. It's going to start getting colder soon. You can prepare for it in advance. This can cut down on the lag, so minimize the perturbation of your feedback system. Help maintain homeostasis. Now, in many cases, this is actually, you know, really good. Generally, this is very adaptive. Sometimes, however, we get into difficulties. And the best way that this has been demonstrated over the years in classical conditioning theory is through the conditioned compensatory responses. I prefer calling them compensatory conditional responses because that's really what we're talking about here, but the original terminology was conditioned compensatory responses. These are conditioned responses that compensate. They are opposite of the UR. So if the UR is going to be an increase in blood pressure, a conditioned compensatory response is going to be a decrease in your blood pressure. The idea is to try to balance your bodily system, maintain that homeostasis. Now, as I said, generally this works just fine. Reduces that kind of fluctuation, reduces lag. However, drug tolerance, we can get into some problems here. Siegel's work, since going back into the 70s, has looked at this. He's worked extensively on drug tolerance, things like heroines and morphines and whatnot. The contextual CSs that are learned in addition to... So when you take when subjects take a drug, be they rats or humans, there's a context in which the drug, morphine, heroin, cocaine, crack, whatever it is being brought into the body. And the contextual CSs, you learn this, in this context, drug is coming, and the body prepares for it, produces a conditional compensatory response there. It says, oh, if the if morphine produces a analgesic effect, so you're no longer feeling pain, that means it's just driving us way out of homeostatic balance. I mean, being able to feel pain is important. You know, if you don't feel pain, you could end up doing things that are going to cause serious damage to yourself. So your body, if you repeatedly are given morphine, your body comes to compensate. Your nervous system does. It's like, right, the U.S. produces analgesia. In this context, these contextual stimuli, they say morphine is coming, need to produce something that's going to compensate for that. So we'll sensitize the body. Will make the body feel pain more. And that'll counteract the analgesic effect so that you stay in homeostasis. That's great, unless, of course, you get into drug tolerances. So if you're trying to get the, you know, your drug addict's going, wow, the morphine just isn't doing anything for me anymore, I'll take more of it to get that same analgesic effect. Your body compensates with a stronger conditioned compensatory response, and so on and so on. This goes on fine until you end up having to take your drug without, in a different context, without the contextual stimuli. In which case, bam, overdose. Okay? Because your body wasn't able to repair. The only way it's been able to maintain this homeostasis and not have horribly ill effects on you is the fact that you've been producing these conditioned compensatory responses. You change the context. Right? If there's nothing, you know, it's like suddenly it's like, whoa, I just got morphine. Uh-oh, thump. Right? If there's no stimulus that tells your system morphine's coming, get ready for it, produce that conditioned compensatory response, oops. In fact, a number of studies, starting with Siegel's, but a number of other studies, and your textbook talks about some of these, have demonstrated with human drug addicts, both in experimental case, but they're not actually giving the drug addicts drugs to see what's going to... It's like, here, take some crack in our lab. It's like, they're not doing that, but they're doing things like showing videos of people taking crack or saying, consider, you know, think about taking, you know, how you normally do your behavior. Go through, you know, go through the whole sort of ritual you have with this up to the point where you actually take your drug. And they monitor them physiologically. They've talked to addicts, various other researchers, including Siegel, talked with addicts who have overdosed but not died, and said, you know, what happened? And very commonly, statistically significantly, it's, yeah, the only thing that was different was I had to change my routine. I couldn't get to where I normally take my drug. I couldn't follow the same ritual pattern, that, you know, ritualization I do with it. I had to change something. So, anyways, preparedness, again, generally very useful, but some cases we can get into some interesting problems there. Okay, so we talk about a lot of mechanisms, and preparedness theory is sort of one very broad theory about classical conditioning. We're now going to talk about some more specific theories and hypotheses about how classical conditioning works. Start with Pavlov's stimulus substitution theory. So basically, Pavlov said here back in, well, originally 1903, although it didn't really get into the English, you know, popular English accounts until 1927, that through repeated pairings of a CS and a US, the CS essentially becomes a substitute for the unconditional stimulus. Consequently, all of the responses that are listed by the US are now also being produced by the CS. So that's his basic idea of stimulus substitution. The CS quite literally substitutes for the US. It takes on the properties of it. Now, remember, Pavlov is a physiologist. He thinks about things in these physiological, neurophysiological ways. So he's figuring that there's some sort of neural process that's going on that's doing this. And looking at things, I mean, unconditional stimuli producing unconscious responses and the kinds of conditional stimuli that he's using producing conditional responses, they kind of match up, right? I mean, food, salivation. Bell paired with food, bell produces salivation. Yeah, seems to work. Other stuff like Jenkins and Moore from 73 doing a classic auto-shaping task here found that pigeons, if given either food or water as the unconditional stimulus, will actually come to peck the conditional stimulus, the key light, so they auto-shape to respond to the key light. If it's food they're being given, it's, you know, it's a little hard to see maybe up on the screen there, but notice that the beak is open. Okay, and that's the same way that they would, and you can see these little dark circles there, that's the key light. That's the little light that they can depress, a little button on the wall. You can light it up sometimes, you know, so to say, hey, here's your CS, here's the light, it's on, and it's a little button, so it's an illuminati. It's an Illuminati button? No, wait, that's something different. Secret organization? No. Yes, the pigeon is corresponding with the Illuminati. No, it's an illuminated button. And so here they're pecking away at it after the light's been turned off. But you can see the beak is open. Same way they go after food. They eat food, they grab the little bits of grain with the open beak. Over here, these pictures of these pigeons here, again, not the easiest to see, but you should be able to see the beak is closed. They are treating the key light as if it has the properties of water. When pigeons drink, they keep their beak fairly closed, and they just stick their tongue out and sort of lap up the water there. So, had another picture from this. It's like, and in frame, you know, taking 64 frames a second here, in frame 3, the tongue can clearly be seen. It's like, I'm blowing it out, you know, it's from the journal article, and I'm like blowing it up, you know, to about 600 times size, and it's like, I guess I can pretend that's maybe a tongue. I'm going to use this picture instead. We'll go with that. So, again, this seems to fit with the stimulus substitution idea. In this case, the stimulus, the CS, really seems to take on the properties of the US. There are some problems, though. Not all of these are necessarily deal breakers. So your conditional stimulus may not be a complete substitution for the US. So think about iBlink. If it's the US, it's a fast, forceful blinking of the eyelid. If it's a CR or CS that produces the CR of blink, it's slower. It's not as forceful. We looked at the underlying, you know, nervous system connections through that. Totally different pathway. So it may get differences in terms of magnitudes, things like that. There may actually be different responses that are being produced. So CSs may produce a different response from USs. This could be omissions or additions in condition suppression in rats. So your US is shock, your UR is a flinch, the CS is tone. Your CR is actually freezing. It's not a flinch, they just stop moving. So, you know, it's, you're omitting, you're not doing the flinch, and you're sort of adding in a freeze response. And then finally, there's the conditioned compensatory responses as well. I mean, that's a case where your CR is completely the opposite of your UR. So all of these are some problems with stimulus substitution theory, saying, you know, it's okay. In some cases, this seems to work, but it doesn't seem to be an exact, you know, this theory doesn't seem to account for exactly what is going on. So what's actually being learned then in classical conditioning is the question. Now, again, as I said, Pavlov very physiologically driven is an approach, very biologically driven here. And so Pavlov suggested that we've got these different centers in the brain. Now, you've also got to cut Pavlov some slight slack here, considering that he's doing this around the turn of the 19th to 20th centuries, when, you know, the kind of ability that neurophysiologists have was, yep, it's a brain. It's got parts. Can you, like, electrically record cells? What? It's a brain. It has parts. This is the front part. Pretty theoretical at this point. So he says, right, let's consider that we've got a U.S. center, a response center, and a CS center. Now, the unconditional stimulus occurs. It sends a signal into our nervous system. Whoops, it vanishes. Nervous system. This then activates some chunk of our nervous system. That's the U.S. center. And this activates then the response center. And then that leads to your response. If you will, now we can talk about that in terms of reflex arc. Okay, whether it cuts through part of the brain or just goes directly through your spinal column, that's our very straightforward reflex pattern there. And again, Pavlov didn't know about the particulars of reflex arcs and the sensory versus the inner neuron and the motor neurons and all that stuff. So he talks about this in terms of centers. Now, in terms of CS, then, so we've now got conditional stimuli that we're associating with the U.S., Pavlov suggests that what this does is the CS comes to activate some other piece of the nervous system, which he just called the CS center. So this activates that, and then there's a couple of possibilities. Either the CS center activates, through some sort of connection, the U.S. center, and then the U.S. center activates the response center. So it could go CS center to U.S. center to response center, and then to response, which would explain why, according to Pavlov, your CR should be very similar to your UR. Or the CS center could perhaps make a direct neural connection with the response center, the neuronal components that produce the response. So through association, the activation of the response center, this is what, if you will, somehow leads connection between the CS center to this active response center, in which case the CS is going to directly connect to the response center, which again explains why, according to Pavlov, the CR should be very much like the UR. It's actually using at least some of the same neural components and architecture. Now, we can talk about these in terms of what are called the stimulus or SS or stimulus-stimulus connections, or the SR stimulus-response connections. Okay, so in terms of how would this be working, it could run from your CS center to your US and then to your response, or it could go just directly from your CS center, your stimulus center, to your response center. So either SS or SR. That's the connection of the question then. What is occurring here? Have we got a stimulus-stimulus or a stimulus-response connection? So your stimulus-stimulus theory says there's two associations. You learn about your CS, so we're presented with our CS-US pairings. The CS, which become the learned stimulus, connects to the U.S. center, and then the U.S. center activates the response center under its existing neural architecture, so the reflex arc, the stuff that's already there, the innate neural connections that are already there. So you've got a learned connection, CS to U.S., and then it takes advantage of the pre-existing architecture. The stimulus response theory says there's only one association that's made here. We go straight from your CS center right to your response center. So in this case here, we'd have our three components. CS center is going to go to US center, and then the US will go to the response. So my dotted line there is trying to represent that's something that has to be learned, and my solid line is something that's, if you will, innate or hardwired, or it's already there. It comes prepackaged with your organism. In contrast, your stimulus response center says that we make a learned connection between our U.S. center and our response center. Which is it? Again, Rescorla here, 1973 experiment, looking at this. So Rescorla used habituation to weaken the U.S. response link. Essentially, devaluation of of the U.S. We already talked about an example of devaluation here, so here he's essentially doing this again. Used a conditioned suppression procedure, in this case loud noise, producing a startle response with rats. Here's our experimental protocol. So we've got a habituation group and a control group. In phase one, both groups, light followed by noise, produces a startle response. Okay. No word of a lie. I kid you not. The way that you measure the startle response is to use what's called a jiggle platform. Really. It's like a little platform that's on little nearly frictionless ball bearings. So you make a clapping noise. The rat goes, bleh! And kind of freaks out a little bit, startles. And the platform goes, finally stops moving. And there'll be a little electrical connection that every time the platform jiggles, it completes a connection. And so a counter will go, you know, 46 jiggles. So you're actually literally measuring jiggles as your unit of startle. How many jiggles did this produce? Ooh, only 6. That's pretty much habituated. Ooh, 75. That's a very startled rat. Okay, jiggle platforms. You can actually buy these things. Anyhow, phase two. In the habituation group, they go through just the presentation of the noise by itself. So they habituate. They present the noise. They present the noise. They present the noise. Control group, no stimuli at all, so no habituation here. And then they test. In the habituation group, the light produces a fairly low conditional response, and in the control group, the light produces a high conditional response. Now, so here we go. In the control, high CR, habituation, low CR. This supports the stimulus-stimulus interpretation. What you're doing here with habituation is you are reducing the activation between the U.S. center and the response center, right? You are reducing the strength of that reflex arc there with habituation, at least temporarily. Now, if the stimulus-response interpretation, the SR theory, was correct, your CS center would just go straight to the response center. You'd bypass... Okay, so what we're doing here is we're weakening this connection with habituation. If SR is correct, big deal. It shouldn't matter because that's irrelevant. We go from the CS center straight to the response. But the fact that devaluing this connection, habituating it here, causes an overall reduction in the CR suggests that, yeah, your CS connects up with your US, and then US activates the response. Okay, so Rescorla's study here provides support for the stimulus-stimulus interpretation of stimulus substitution. It's unfortunate that we've got stimulus-stimulus and stimulus substitution because they both involve a bunch of S's. So, anyways, maybe that's a way to think about it. Remember it. Which is right? Stimulus substitution, stimulus-stimulus as opposed to SR, stimulus substitution, SS, stimulus-stimulus, SS. Called mnemonic. Okay, good. Figured out. CSUS influence. Okay, so we already talked about this. We talked about sign tracking. Okay, but there's other things that can influence the conditional response here, as well as whether or not we're dealing with the stimulus substitution interpretation and whatnot. So back with Timberlake and Grant, this is the one where they're doing sign tracking, except instead of having a light or something like this being turned on to indicate to the our conditioning rat, a second rat serves as the CS. And in fact, what we get is conditional responses that are social in nature, not consumatory. Our conditioned rat here doesn't go over and try to gnaw on our CS rat. It instead goes over and does grooming and begging behaviors. So again, it's related to food, but it's not quite the same. More recently, and this is actually from Doug Grant, who's currently the chair of the department. So, you know, little connection there, you know. If you have a hard time remembering this, just, you know, go on over to Doug's office and, hey, is the chair in? I need to talk to him about a study he did, you know, 35 years ago. Yeah, okay. Anyways, maybe bring coffee or something for him. Aikens in 2000, more recently, worked with quails. Quails are nice to work with. They're small. They're easy to handle. They don't take up a lot of room. the cute, you know, that helps. So take a look at the male quail's behavior sequence when looking for females to mate with. They will start by doing what's called a general search, and as they get closer and closer to the female, they move into a focal search for the female. So they start broadly wandering around. Hello! Any female quails around that may be interested in mating? Anybody at all? I see sign that a female quail has passed this way recently. I will look more in this area, okay? So, you know, they're on the hunt for the female to try to impress with their virile quail courtship dance. Anyways, Aikens took and used a conditional stimulus, a light, as the visual stimulus, and the U.S. was a female quail. Okay. Had two different CS-US intervals, either a short one-minute interval, so CS and then US, 1 minute apart, or long 20-minute interval between our stimuli. Here's what she found. In the same way that Timberlake and Grant found that the nature of the CS influenced the CR, so it's our CS is a rat. You don't try to eat the rat, you try to beg or groom. So food begging behaviors there. We get something here. When the pair, when you, okay, blue line represents paired CSUS. In other words, there's a contingency between them. In other words, that's our experimental set here, the blue. Our red is unpaired. They're just randomly presented. They get the same number of CSs and USs, but in a random sequence. Okay, so in terms of focal search, the conditional response measure she used was the percentage of time spent near the CS. Now remember, in terms of focal, in the male quail's search behavior for a female, focal means he's already pretty close to her. Okay, so he's going to stick pretty close, try to keep other male quails away, try to impress her with his masculine quailness. Okay, so he's going to stick close. When the CSUS interval between the light and the presentation of the female was only 1 minute, this seems to activate the focal search pattern, right? They spend, the males spend a lot of time near the light. Okay, it's like, oh, light indicates female, light, female. They don't try to dance for the female. They don't try to mate with the, or pardon me, they don't try to dance for the light. They don't try to do their courtship ritual to the light. They don't try to mate with the light, none of that. They just hang out close to it. Light means female. If I have a stimulus that indicates a female is like within 1 minute's travel, what would I do? I would stay pretty close here. So they do that. 20 minutes, they're not spending much time near the light. It's like, you know, something that says, female, 20 minutes away. I'm going to stay right here. Well, you got 20 minutes to go, dude. You know, staying right here means she's just going to stay 20 minutes away. She's not in the area, right? So if the CS interval, US interval is short, activates this focal search behavior in terms of the sign. So, I mean, treating this as sign tracking. In terms of general search, you can't use quite the same thing because the behavior is different. In general search, the male quail is going to be much more active. It's like running around. It's like, show me some sign. Show me where the female is. I've got to find some indication. Female footprints. She went this way. Off he goes. So Aikens used pacing or the number of crossings from one side of the cage to the other. In other words, the activity of the quail, blah, 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 back and forth. If the CSUS interval is short, they mainly just stay put. They don't move around very much at all. If the CS interval is the 20 minutes, it's the long one, that really activates this general search pattern. Okay, it's like, oh, she's around here. She's someplace. I need to run around and find some indication of where she is. Must be active. So lots of running back and forth in the apparatus. Okay. So again, the idea in sign tracking that just because you've got a CS and a US doesn't mean that you're always going to get the same kind of CR. The CS-US interaction is going to be important in terms of producing the conditional response. Now, with respect to then our stimulus substitution theory. I'm sorry. You know what? This is what I was talking about in terms of... Let me change this. Okay. Stim sub theory. Just to distinguish this from the stimulus-stimulus interpretation. Okay. For Pavlov's... I mean, Pavlov's original stimulus-substitution theory doesn't actually work, just as he envisioned it from, you know, over 100 years ago. It has to be modified some. You have to be able to allow flexibility into the system. So there needs to be some flexibility in terms of your conditional response, unconditional response relationship here. It means that we don't have something as simple as just CS center going to response center. CS center going to US center and then US center activating response. It's a more complicated process here. So your CS is not being associated with all aspects of the US, just some of them. And again, if you go back, a couple of chapters when we were looking at the eye blink conditioning and the work at looking at the neural pathways there, you can see, I mean, there's some commonalities of the neural systems that are involved in your reflex, so your USTUR and the eye blink, and there's a whole bunch of other stuff brought in terms of the CS to CR. So they're activating some of the same things, but also some different stuff. And so for stimulus substitution to work in this way, it really requires that you allow for the fact that it's not just a simple mono connection here, single connection between your CS center to your US center. So there's an interaction going on somehow. And then your conditional response, consequently, is going to depend upon some of the sensory properties of the CS, as well as some of the context in terms of the presentation, in terms of the learning. Okay. Next one we're going to take a look at here is Roscorla-Wagner. Now, we've gone through the basics of Roscorla-Wagner in 281, so we're not going to cover too much of that here. We have some other things with it. But Roscorla-Wagner looks at classical conditioning learning as a discrepancy between your expectation and the actual occurrence. So if your expectation of what's going to happen is essentially the same as what really happens, you're not learning anything. Right? So if you have essentially, you know, if you go, yes, the CS is, if you have learned to the point where CS is this exact predictor of US, if you've got that and you're making the strongest conditional response that you can, at that point, for all intents and purposes, your learning is done. If suddenly something changes, right, like extinction, it's like, hey, wait a minute, I got the CS, no US. What the what? Expectation, should we get in the US? Occurrence, no US. Whoa. We call that surprise. Or, you know, the Keanu Reeves, you know, it's like, whoa. It's like, what just happened there? I have no idea. Better pay attention. Okay? So, the more surprised, if you will, if you just want to talk this way, the more surprising an event is, or the less the occurrence actually matches up with the expectation, the greater the degree of conditioning, the more you're going to be learning there. So the more surprising, the more you're learning. Think about this in terms of early versus later trials. Running through a Roscorla-Wagner model and even looking at your general learning curve, you know, you learn most in the early trials. As you approach your asymptotic maximum of learning on each trial, you continue to learn a little bit, but relatively speaking, it's going to be less and less and less and less. First time you read a chapter in the textbook, hopefully you learned a lot of stuff. Second time, you learn some more stuff, but you know, picking up details. Third time, you read the chapter, you're focusing in on some really specific. Fourth time, you read the chapter. 19th time, you've read chapter 4 in your text. You haven't done that yet? Get going. Yeah, okay. Look, at some point, this means there's going to be a diminishing return. What this is saying is at some point, just stop reading that chapter over and over and over again. But I have to memorize every... No, you don't. At some point, there's a diminishing payoff, right? Yes, you will keep learning little bits and bobs, but big deal. You're, practically speaking, not gaining anything additional. Now, there's nothing really surprising in there. Huh. That's very odd in terms of weird little squares. Okay. Anyways, those squares were supposed to be little black dots. I don't know what happened. Doesn't show up that way on my Mac. Curse you, Windows system. Okay, so Ruspoldt-Wagner mathematical model. Here we go. So the triangle, delta. So delta V sub n equals K times lambda minus V sub n, close brackets. So V, anytime you see a V in Ruspoldt-Wagner, that just represents the CSUS, the associative strength. Okay? Ruspoldt-Wagner is what we call an associative model. It says what you have learned is due to the amount of association you have made between your stimuli. All right. Delta, the delta just means change. Okay, so delta V, change in the associative strength per trial. K is a salience term. It just refers to the salience of the stimuli involved, your CS and US. For our purposes, we'll treat this as a constant. Funny little thing here. Looks sort of like a vague, maybe a seal or something, right? There's his flippers down, there's his head, body coming back to a tail. Okay, it's a lambda sign. It represents the asymptotic maximum of V. This is going to be due to the properties of the unconditional stimulus. All right? In some other places, you may see this listed as not a funny little lambda, but as a something that says V max. Maximum. It's the maximum amount that you can possibly learn about the system. And then consequently, this term in brackets, your maximum learning minus your current learning, indicates how surprising things are. If these little subscripts of n just indicate what trial you're on. Okay, so just consider, if you have done no conditioning at all, okay, on trial one, the amount of prior conditioning is zero, okay, and you could have a maximum of, I don't care, 100 units of associative strength. Wow, the difference between your maximum and your current is 100. That's a lot, right? If you've done a number of trials and you've acquired 50 units of associative strength, well, how surprising is it? 100 minus 50? It's half as surprising. You're not going to learn as much that trial, okay? So, now in terms of blocking, Ruspoldt-Wagner deals with blocking by saying that, again, what's going to happen is your CS1 gets paired up with your US repeatedly. So the your V, representing CS1, the amount of associative strength acquired by the CS is approaching, should be a 1. Weird. The amount of strength as you pair your CS1 with the US is going to approach proportionately. Okay, I see what happened. Lambda. Changed fonts on me. I have to use a symbol font to get that. I'm sorry. There we go. In Greek script, lowercase l is lambda. It approaches lambda. Okay, I'm sorry. Here we go. Let's try that again. So you go through, you pair CS1 with US. CS1 US, CS1 US, CS1 US. The amount of associative strength acquired by your CS1 is approaching the maximum. It's approaching your lambda, okay? That funny little squiggle, okay? By the time that your second conditional stimulus gets added in, now we're doing a compound, CS1 plus CS2, paired with US, there's just not a lot left to be gained. Your VCS1 is almost your total. If you got 100 units of associative strength total, if lambda equals 100, by the time your CS2 is added in, maybe you've got 95 units of associative strength that have been acquired by your CS1. It's only 5 units left, assuming that your two stimuli, your CS1 and CS2, are equally salient. You're going to split that remaining 5 between both. So if you ran a huge number of trials, CS1 is going to have 95 plus another 2.5, so 97.5 units out of 100, and your CS2 is only going to have 2.5. The strength of your conditional response is dependent upon the amount of associative strength that a stimulus has acquired. So in that case, you're just not going to have a strong conditional response. If you will, another way to look at syndrome surprisingness is your CS1 is extremely predictive of the US. Okay, your expectation is when the CS1 is presented, US is going to follow. If you will, it's not very surprising, so you don't need to pay much attention to this CS2. It's not, your expectation is already pretty fixed. It's like, I'm expecting the US, and sure enough, there it is. Okay? So, that's what it says with respect to blocking. And so it does a really good job of explaining blocking. Predicts, does a beautiful job of predicting the blocking effect. Now, if the Rosano Wagner could only predict blocking and deal with blocking, explain it, you'd go, big deal. Not a great theory. It's got some other stuff it can do, you know. It's not just a one-trick pony. Over-expectation effect, actually predicted by the Roscorlo-Wagner model before it was empirically demonstrated. So Roscorlo-Wagner played around with the model and said, well, what does this suggest? It's like, hey, it suggests over-expectation. We should try that. Here's over-expectation. In phase one, pair a light with one pellet of food. Pair a tone with one pellet of food. These are not a compound stimulus. On some trials, you light, pellet of food. On other trials, randomly, you randomly mix these up, tone, one pellet of food, okay? So we do this in phase one in our over-expectation group and our control group, okay? So this is what we're learning. Light means a piece of food, tone means a piece of food. Phase two, we do this. We now produce a compound CS. We present light and tone together, and we give one piece of food. Okay. In phase two, in the control, nothing. We test, we present the light by itself, the tone by itself, and what we get here is for our over-expectation group, we get a moderate conditional response. In the control group, we get a strong conditional response. Look back here into phase two. Okay, from phase one, we've come to expect light equals one piece of food, tone equals one piece of food. Light and tone together, light should be one, tone should be one, should be getting two pieces of food. I'm expecting two. But you only get one. Whoa. Expectation, very different from the occurrence. Must learn more. What do they learn now? They're learning, oh. Together, light and tone equals one. It's not light equals one, tone equals one. Light and tone together equal one. Or light equals a half, tone equals a half. After we go through this, we test this out. Moderate CR, moderate CR. For a control group, light equals one, tone equals one. Still, light equals one, tone equals one. Strong CR. Okay, you know, if we were to like sum the amount of, I don't know, whatever, rat salivation that we got here for moderate, we'd probably have the equivalent of a strong CR. All right? And again, this gets predicted by the actual model. So we actually, that was actually found empirically after the model predicted it. Now, that being said, there's some stuff that's kind of, incredibly awkward with the Roscorlo-Wagner model. It can cope with it, but it does it in not the nicest kind of way. It's kind of a kludge. So, consider condition inhibition. We have an excitatory CS, and we've got an inhibitory CS. Right? So CS plus CS minus. Put them together, CS minus seems to cancel the effect of the CS plus. No conditional response. Okay? Opponent process system, in essence. They cancel out. Now, let's consider. Let's treat our tone as our CS plus and our light as our CS minus. So we've done our conditioning on this. Okay, we've established a CS plus and a CS minus here. We got to take a look. And this is what I said. This gets kind of clunky. I'm not going to, on an exam, I'm not going to ask you to like grind out numbers for this. Okay, I'm not going to ask you to calculate something like this on an exam. So don't worry about that. So just try to sort of see why this is kind of so awkward here. So we'll say, remember, the strength of your CR is due to the amount of associative strength that you've got. So our tone is our CS plus, so the amount of associative strength from the tone, let's just call it 100. Again, remember, in Roscorlo-Wagner, the associative units are just hypothetical, so most people just work with nice round numbers. Our light is our CS minus. We'll treat light as having a value of zero. It's acquired no units of associative strength yet. Let's put a salience of 0.2. And we've got to set lambda to zero. If you remember, talk about this back in 281, the way that Ruskorla-Wagner deals with extinction, so if acquisition increases the amount of associative strength, so if we like go up to a lambda of 100, extinction, we just treat lambda as zero, and we take it back down to zero. So the idea is we just eliminate the associative strength, which is not really how extinction works, so it's clunky there too. Anyways, we're going to define, we're going to bring in another term here to fix the, to make this work, V sum. Our V sum is going to be the total amount of associative strength between our V tone and our V light. Okay, so V max here, instead of lambda, I'm just going to put V max just to remind you. This would be the maximum that we could have. Okay, and we're treating our V sum here as this composite. Okay, so there's our CS plus, there's our CS minus. First trial here. So our first trial, a change. 0.2 times, remember, our Vmax or lambda is starting at 0. So it's K times lambda minus Vn. Okay, so our V sum is going to be 100. Because we're starting out, we've set V tone at 100. V light, we started out with 0. So V sum is V tone plus V light, or 100. So we plunk 100 in here. 0 minus 100 times 0.2 minus 20. Okay. Then for the second trial, so we've got an acquisition here. The amount of associative strength we've got is negative 20. Wait, what's that mean? It means essentially we've lost 20 units of associative strength. Okay, so the first time we pair our CS plus and our CS minus together, we lose some associative strength. Let's subtract that from both. So the change then, V tone minus 20 becomes 80. V light minus 20 is, oh, minus 20. Okay, so we have 80 minus 20. Now our V sum, remember, is V tone plus V light, 80 minus 20, 60. We do this here then. So 0 now minus 60 times 0.2 is minus 12. So on our second trial, we get another change of, now we lose another 12 units of associative strength. 80 minus 12 becomes 68. Minus 20 minus 12 is minus 32. 68 minus 32 is 36. As I said, I'm not going to ask you to calculate this in an exam. Please believe me on this. What I'm really just trying to show you here is that while the Ruskorla-Wagner can explain some things very nicely, to try to get a system that works to explain condition inhibition, they got to do some kind of bizarre stuff, okay? And biologically, it doesn't really seem to work this way, right? And so on, okay? So then for our next one here, 0.2 times 0 minus 36 minus 7.2, and it just keeps going like this. Now what's happening here is our V tone then is going to approach 50, and our V light, our CS minus, is going to approach minus 50. So if we were to plot this, we'd say, again, think of it as an opponent process, right? The strength of your conditional response is going to be the sum of your CS plus and your CS minus, right? So here's, if you will, what happens to your V tone. It starts at the same point, as it starts with 100, and in essence, after all of this, it ends up at 50. And our light ends up at minus 50. So at this point here, after a whole bunch of conditioning trials, plus 50 plus minus 50, zero. So now when the CS plus and the CS minus are together, they cancel out completely and you get no conditional response. Along the way here, if we check on trial one, you know, we'd have 80 minus 20 is 60. It's about there on our V sum. And down over here, it's whatever trial this is, trial 60.8, okay, the fourth trial, 60.8 minus 39.2, 22, so somewhere down about here on the graph in terms of the net sum there, okay? So Ruskorla-Wagner can deal with it, but it's not in an especially beautiful way. CS pre-exposure effect. In this case here, we give we're giving our CS by itself, pre-exposure to the CS. So we present the thing that's going to become a CS by itself, present. Control group, we skip that whole phase. We just go straight to the CS paired with the US. Okay. Then if we test how long it's going to take to get the CR in both groups. Okay. So we've said that the way that we want to think about this is habituation of our pre-exposure group. Now, in this case here, you know, we've said that you're perhaps paying less attention to your CS plus, or pardon me, to your CS, the pre-exposed CS. So CS has become irrelevant, it's non-predictive, and that you have to unlearn this during, you know, quote-unquote, unlearn during the test phase. So that's what we've talked about in terms of our CS pre-exposure effect. Okay, and that makes a certain amount of sense. How about Rescorla Wagner? Thank you for playing. You do not win. Rescorla Wagner can't cope with this really at all. Rescorla Wagner model has no actual way of explaining this. On the first pre-exposure trial, you've had, according to the Rescorla Wagner interpretation, no prior conditioning. Because conditioning occurs when your CS is paired or not paired with the US. In other words, your expectation, does it differ from the actual occurrence? Well, if you're just presented with a tone by itself and nothing happens, you got nothing, right? My expectation is, I don't know. My response, or the outcome is, nothing. Huh. Well, I didn't expect anything to happen, and in fact, nothing did happen. There was no US, so I had no expectations about the tone. I've been presented with the tone. There's no US, so I expected nothing. I got nothing. There should be no learning. Consequently, when you then go about and start associating your pre-exposed CS with the US, according to Rescorla Wagner, this should just be a basic, straightforward, unaffected association trial. There should be no delay or no reduction in the amount of conditioning going on. But something is being learned here. Now, one attempt to deal with this in Rescorla Wagner, and it's not a good attempt because there's problems by doing this, is to suggest that perhaps your K term, the salience, is variable. It's not a constant. So perhaps trying to salvage this out of Rescorla Wagner, maybe salience, you know, as you're pre-exposing the CS, the salience of it is decreasing during the pre-exposure. That's like the habituation. And therefore, you're paying less attention to the CS during those initial acquisition trials. But then you got to say, okay, so how do we account for now the rate at which your salience reoccurs? How does this suddenly go from being a salience of perhaps zero up to a salience of something, you know, 0.2 or whatever it is? Remember, good theories can actually predict specific things. You kind of got to look at it after the fact and go, well, you know, we can look at other empirical data and make an estimate. Yeah. Okay. So, you know, don't get me wrong. I don't want to slag the Rescorla Wagner entirely here. Very good starting point for all of this. Let me just say that there are no perfect theories of classical conditioning. None of the theories out there account for everything. We all seem to do little segments of things, which is kind of cool because it means we haven't figured it all out yet, so we've still got more to learn. In other words, we keep being surprised. Our expectation is not always going to meet up with the outcome. Other things, as I said, extinction. We don't really, in extinction, we're not actually returning to zero associative strength, okay? So there's a problem with that, right? That would be like forgetting. Okay, so Kluge. In the CS minus, we extinguish the CS minus not by presenting it by itself, but by extinguishing the CS plus. Again, Rescorla Wagner has no way to actually deal with that. It also requires that a stimulus must be either a CS plus or a CS minus. Can't be both depending on the context. And in fact, we can't actually produce conditional stimuli that are either a CS plus or a CS minus, depending upon the context, other contextual stimuli set up what your CS is going to act as. It's kind of an odd empirical methodology to do that, but we can do it. Again, Rescorla Wagner can't cope with that. So, what other models are out there? Well, there's a number of models that are called attentional models. And most of these actually came out of the UK in Europe. So in the time when Ruscoello Wagner is being very interesting in the 70s in North America, much of UK and European psychologists were looking at a different approach. They were looking at what they called attentional models. So look, there's a whole bunch of stimuli in the environment. You can't possibly pay attention to all of them. You've got to have some sort of selection process where, if you will, you know, you remove the signal, what you need, from all the background noise. Cocktail party, right? Think about that. You can really only attend to one conversation. Now, if you try to pay attention to like multiple people speaking at the same time, and then we go back subsequently and try to test you on what was said in the conversations, it's like, I heard my name occasionally. Yeah, you remember that. It's particularly salient to you, so you got that, but you don't remember the content of the conversations. You really only attend to one thing. So you pick something, you attend to it for a while, and your attention may shift to something else. Okay. So attentional models. McIntosh, a British psychologist. So McIntosh's theory. McIntosh treats salience as a variable, not a constant. And I said, you know, back when trying to deal with this with Ruscoello-Wagner, we might try to treat this as a constant, but it creates problems for the rest of theory. McIntosh treats salience just as a variable throughout learning. He says it's not, you know, your salience towards things is not going to be a constant. He says, let's consider you've got two stimuli, a light and a tone. If the light is a better predictor of the unconditional stimulus, then the salience of the light is going to increase and the salience of the tone will decrease. By doing so, this allows you to identify the more relevant stimuli in terms of predicting what's going to occur. The light, if you will, is a better signifier of the outcome than the tone is. The tone just becomes noise. So attend to the light. If this changes, if now the light is no longer, we start to make the light a poor predictor, we screw around with the, say, contingency or contiguity of the light, but we keep contingency contiguity with respect to tone. Now the salience of the light will start to drop, and the salience of the tone will start to increase. So we can learn to shift to a new predictor stimulus. McIntosh's theory says organisms will simply attend to the most informative stimulus that is available. In terms of blocking. Says, okay, so let's say we train on a light, okay, so CS light paired with the US, salience of the light increases. The light is predictive of the CS, hence we attend to the light. Now we move into the compound conditional stimulus phase. We bring in a tone. So what this says here is our light, very predictive, high salience. Salience of tone then, not that predictive. We've actually got an excellent predictor already. The light, that is what we are tending to. Salience of tone will drop towards zero throughout these trials because the light is a better predictor. We've already established this as a really good predictor. Consequently, we pay less and less and less attention to the tone. And after a few trials of this, we've got very little salience with respect to the tone. Consequently, when we look to conditional response, that goes with the light. Okay, so a little attention directed towards the tone, weak conditional response. Second attentional theory, slightly different here from McIntosh, is Pearson-Hall's theory. This one says conditional stimuli are going to become ineffective whenever the unconditional stimulus is already well predicted. So if you've already got a good predictor for the CS, there's no point wasting, you know, cognitive load paying attention to other stuff. But if the situation changes so that now the U.S. is surprising, right? There's something that happens there that's changed. It's like, whoa, that was unexpected. Well, that would mean that the CSs you've already learned about were not as predictive as you thought. Now it's time to start learning about something new in the environment that is going to be predictive. That is going to increase your ability to predict the occurrence of your U.S. So attention to the conditional stimulus will depend upon the surprisingness of the U.S. on previous on the previous trial or on previous trials. Okay, so how surprising was the U.S. on the last trial? That's what's going to determine how much you attend to particular stimuli in the subsequent trials. And it assumes then that what happens is your surprisingness of your unconditional stimulus is going to alter the attention paid to conditional stimuli on the next trial. In the Mascola-Wagner, we talk about surprisingness in the Mascola-Wagner as well. It says the surprisingness of the unconditional stimulus on a trial determines what is learned on that trial. Pearson Hall say you get a surprising U.S. that doesn't cause you to learn a whole bunch more about a CS right then, but on the next trial, it's like, whoa, I better pay attention to that CS. I'm going to look for see what happened there because that was unexpected. Scholar Wagner says, no, if it's surprising, that affects learning right then on the same trial. In terms of blocking, what can attentional theories do here? Well, in the first compound CS trial, your CS2 should be quite surprising, right? You've previously only had your CS1 paired with the U.S. So it's like, yeah, expecting CS1 goes with the U.S. Yeah, it's like, whoa, there was another stimulus here. Well, that was unexpected. What that should mean is on the next trial, you should really attend to your CS2 because first trial, consider Pearson Hall here, first trial there of your compound stimulus, you're expecting the CS1. Sure enough, you get it, but you also get CS2. Surprise! Now, they say that that's going to cause you to attend more to the CS2, this novel stimulus of the next trial. So we should get a lot of learning occurring. We should learn something about the CS2 because it was unexpected, it was surprising, it was novel. But in fact, we don't. It seems that what happens here is, in fact, the CS1 actually blocks learning about the CS2 from the very first compound CS trial. In other words, having a CS2 tossed in there is not really all that surprising. So attentional theory's got a problem with blocking. Yeah. Yeah. So could we have a case where the CS2 is actually just being associated more with the CS1 and not with the U.S.? Possibly, but in either case, according to attentional theory, it's still a change, and it's the thing that is novel and surprising, and so that should cause a focusing of attention on it, and we don't get that. So even if that were kind of the way this were working, it's still a problem for the way the theory works. Temporal coding hypothesis looks at this and says it's a very contiguity-driven theory, so a different approach here. It says, look, we've got to deal with timing effects. Now, I should say temporal coding hypothesis is a much more limited theoretical approach to classical conditioning than either Rescorla-Wagner or the attentional models because it's really just dealing with timing effects. Okay, so if it's not timing, it's really not involved. Okay. Consider an ISI, interstimulus interval. We can have either a short delay versus long delay or trace. Well, clearly, the timing there is significant. Short delay, much easier to condition than long delay or trace. With respect to ITI, time seems to be involved. The intertrial interval, generally, we get stronger conditional responses I was typing this up very quickly last night to try to get you a lecture, when it's spaced further apart. So, again, timing comes into play here. CS duration, the amount of time the CS is actually present for. Again, this can influence learning. What are we seeing? Timing. So according to proponents of the temporal coding hypothesis, clearly we attend a lot to issues about time. That must be really important. So they say we learn not just that a CS is paired up with a US, but also when the US is going to occur. So the timing arrangement must be something we attend to. Holland has done something rather interesting with this. He did a study where U.S. was food, the CS was a noise, and treated the CR as the time spent, the rats would spend over at the food cup, snuffling around the food cup looking for food. He said, let's consider CS durations. And he said, let's talk about what we call trial duration, T, of 10 or 20 seconds, the amount of time your CS is presented for. Okay, so just the amount of time the CS is on, either 10 seconds or 20 seconds. And I don't know if this is actually due to my typing or if it's some sort of functions trying to correct spelling mistakes from last night. That might be it. Six ITIs. Yes, that's what it did. Tried to turn it into something. Damn, I hate Microsoft products. I think they know what I'm talking about. Six ITIs of 15 to 90, 960 seconds. So different groups had different ITIs, intertrial intervals. I said, now, look, we've got some differences here. Either 10-second duration of the CS or 20-second duration. But when we look at this as your ITI or I to T ratio here, it doesn't really matter whether our T is 10 or 20 seconds. We get the same basic pattern. So if we look at this in terms of temporal a ratio of the timing, sure, we can scale things up or scale them down, but we'll get the same, relatively speaking, the same behavior in relation to timing effects. Now again, very limited to timing systems. The rate estimation system extension, this one's just kind of wonky. Promoted largely by Gazzaniga, who I've met. He's a nice guy, interesting guy, but yeah. So it's an extension of what's called the relative waiting time hypothesis. Again, very time-driven. Says that your CS is only going to be informative about your US if you spend less time waiting for the US when the CS is present. So in other words, do you get the US faster if your CS is going to be predictive here? Rate estimation theory takes this a little bit further. It's a non-associative theory. It says, you know, we're not dealing with here an association between the CS and the US. We're just dealing with strength and conditional responses due to subjects estimating the rate of the US presentations during a CS or during the absence of the CS. CS is not being associated with the US. It's an estimation of the probabilities of occurrence. Problems with this are neurologically, it just doesn't seem to work. Neurologically speaking, our nervous systems don't seem to work this way. Gazzaniga's theory does, Gaussel's theory does work, perhaps, empirically under very controlled laboratory situations where there are a very limited number of components that need to be encoded. In the real world, though, it seems highly unlikely that humans or even non-humans or humans would actually be able to make these kinds of computations, the probabilities of occurrence of US in the presence of a CS or in the absence of the CS. So in very controlled, limited, simplified situations, okay, perhaps. Real world, highly unlikely. Comparator hypothesis. I know, I'm sorry, I'm trying to just kind of get through this here. I know. Kind of interesting with respect to blocking. There's a cool thing with this. The traditional interpretation for blocking is that we've got a failure to learn about the CS2, right? CS1's acquired mostly associated strength, that's most predictive, what have you. Comparator hypothesis says that subjects actually learn about the CS2, but the ability to respond is blocked. So it's not that your ability to learn is blocked. Comparator interpretation says your ability to respond to the CS2 is restricted. Now, I'm doing something cool here. It's called a revaluation effect. It shows that actually something has been learned about the CS2. So we go through this. We do our CS1 paired with US. Then we do our compound CS1 with CS2. Then what we do is we extinguish the CS1. If we do that, and now we test CS2, we actually get a conditional response. Now, that's cool, because according to all the other interpretations of blocking, once you've learned about the CS1, you're just not going to learn about the CS2, or at least there's not much left for you to learn. What this is saying, what comparator hypothesis says, is you're learning about the CS2, But something, what your previous learning about the CS1 inhibits the response to the CS2 until you've eliminated the CS1, until you've extinguished the CS1. Then suddenly CS2 becomes really important because it's now the only predictor you got left for the US, and you've encoded that information in there. Now, the thing about the comparator hypothesis is it's a theory of performance. It is not a theory of learning per se. It says, here's a behavior. This explains it. It's like, how does it work? How does the learning occur? Don't know. It's like, okay, so lovely explaining these kinds of effects, very, very nice, but in terms of what are the underlying processes, you know, could a cognitive psychologist take this or a neuropsychologist take it? It's like, not so well, not so much. Okay, so in that sense, a little bit different. Just a second. So it says here, conditional responding is going to be dependent upon our association in our CS in the U.S. We're going to have association in the U.S. and other stimuli. Call these the comparator cues. Now, comparator cues may also include your experimental context. So consider some other things. Consider excitatory and inhibitory conditional stimuli. Comparator hypothesis only allows for excitatory association with the U.S. Wait a minute. How do we get a CS minus then? It says your excitation or inhibition is going to work in an opponent's or a process system, except what you're doing is you have a certain amount of excitation with respect to your CS, and then you have a certain amount of excitation that gets associated with all the other stimuli out there, the comparator stimuli. Let's just call them your context cues. If the excitation produced by your tone is more than the excitation produced by all your other context cues, great, your tone becomes a CS+. If the excitation gained by your tone is less than all the excitation produced by your context cues or your comparator cues, then you're not going to get a conditional response to the tone. In fact, if it is, if the excitation to your tone, your CS, is that much weaker, is so much weaker than the excitation gained by your comparator stimuli, comparator cues, then in fact your tone may actually become a CS-. Okay, so we've got another opponent process type model here. So we keep encountering opponent process systems. Now again, it doesn't really explain the underlying components of the learning system there. I'm going to ask you to talk to me afterwards, whatever your question was. Okay, look. We're scheduled for a midterm on Thursday. Somebody's already emailed me going, could you please put up some sample questions? I would love to. I still don't have access to the exam bank. And, you know, I need that. So I have been having endless amounts of trouble with Nelson getting this. I keep going, I need access to this. They say, yeah. We've given you the passwords. You got the clearance. There you go. It's like, dudes, it doesn't work. I still can't get to it. Oh, we've reinitiated your passwords. I still can't get in. There you go. It's like, oh, contact tech support. I have. Email to tech support doesn't work. So hopefully, I was talking with somebody about this morning before coming into my 281 class. I've been here all day since like 10:30 to now. I'm going to go back out to my office now, and hopefully there will be an email there with some software that I need to possibly be able to open the exam bank files so that I can, one, make us an exam for Thursday, and two, give you some sample questions. I will email people through, you know, your ualberta.ca account, as I do when other stuff gets posted. As soon as I've got something I can put up for sample questions for you, I will let you know on this, okay? My prediction is we will have some sort of exam on Thursday. If I suddenly go insane and end up, like, hopping in my car and driving to Nelson headquarters and, like, whacking people there, the tech support, with a baseball bat, we will not have an exam on Thursday, for I will probably have been arrested. But I doubt they will be able to take me alive. So, you'll find out about that by watching CNN. Crazed Canadian psychologist goes nuts in American publishing house. Filmed at 11. All right. I will let you know through email as soon as I have sample questions to give you and whatnot. I will let you know. I'm very sorry about this. Again, this all goes back to my taking this course on at, you know, the day after it was supposed to start at 4:30, and nothing's been prepped yet. Yes, somebody there.
So what are the chances?
What are the chances of us not having an exam on Thursday? Very low. I have to give you an exam somehow because it's in the syllabus. If I can't get this straightened out by, say, you know, tomorrow afternoon by 2, I will have to talk to the associate undergraduate chair of the department and say, here's the problem. And she'll make a decision as to what we do about this. At present, the plan is that you need to have a midterm. So, yeah. We potentially could, but that's a change in the syllabus. I'd have to get approval from every person in the university writes. I have to get approval from every person in the class in writing to move an exam. It's for the student's own safety. Okay? But since not everybody, it's supposed to be 30 people in the class, I know there are not 30 of you here. Hopefully, I will have access to this by, you know, in an hour or two from now, and I will let you know what's going on. Okay.